Let's get ready to... Welcome to the Humanist Hour. In this month's episode, we will be talking about Voyeur Jesus, the god on the throne, and you can decide which kind of throne, and complex subjectivity.
Also on this month's broadcast, what Jesus did with his penis, a eulogy for God, and humanism and hip-hop. Our guest this month, Dr. Anthony B. Pinn.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour. I'm Todd.
I'm Kim.
So how's it going, Kim? What's going on with you and your side of the world? You know, like
my
a mile
side of the
away
world.
From here. Hey, your side of the lake.
Yeah, that's true, right? My side of the lake, it's going pretty well. We had the crazy snow. I think probably everybody has seen the picture of the burning car in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Snowpocalypse.
Burning in the snow, yeah. Apocalypse, but it was gone 2 days later. This is one thing I love about this state is it was 70 today, so apocalypse is officially over, Todd. We're all right, we're safe. Yeah,
we survived. Although I did hear the Viking apocalypse is this weekend. Just for the record, we've already had the Mayan. It missed. The Christians were wrong with the whole Harold camping thing, but the Vikings. Thor is going to mess some stuff up this weekend, folks.
Everybody's going down on Saturday.
Yep.
Are you ready?
Everyone's going down or just the Norse gods?
Oh, I think just the Norse gods. I identify with them very much, apparently.
Indeed.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be at a summit for Camp Quest on Saturday, so we'll have to. Maybe I'll wear my Viking helmet. Yeah,
You should be wearing a helmet because when Thor comes cracking that hammer, you need all the protection you're going to get.
Yeah, I do. That's funny. Yeah, I'm scared.
There's some good news this month. There's actually a couple pieces of good news, but one interesting thing going on, which I guess the fact that it is going on is not good news, but the fact that so far we've been winning is good, is there's been a whole slew of these right to discriminate laws. I mean, I'm sorry, right to religious freedom laws going on.
So,
what are your thoughts on these, Kim?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first thing, I mean, I guess probably most folks know that Ted Cruz and Mike Lee in the federal government have proposed a bill that will actually nullify any state legal same-sex marriages when they enter a state that does not have marriage equality. Okay. So the funniest response I saw to this, well, funny not in the ha-ha way, but funny as in well done, that was very clever, was a meme that went around that said, my civil rights shouldn't change with my zip code. And I was like, you know, that is, I like that. I wish I was clever enough to come up with that stuff on my own. But I was like, good on you. Seriously, Ted Cruz? But yes, Todd, the good news is that 5 different states this week either pulled before voting or vetoed bills allowing discrimination. And I don't understand, no matter what your background is, I don't understand how you can mistake religious freedom and discrimination.
Because it's useful. So if you're on the side that wants to discriminate, then intentionally confusing the two is a useful strategy that has been working sort of. But as one of the articles I was reading about this topic was saying, like, you know, anybody who votes for this might want to reconsider, because if you want to get any votes from anyone under the age of 50 and a whole slew of people over 50, you got to think about the demographics, because everyone in this country that's young just about is opposed to, you know, legalized religious discrimination. And it's true. I mean, these are very short-term political maneuverings that I think are really just about trying to galvanize the base of religious conservatives and kind of the last throes of pushback, because they've lost. They've lost morally. They've lost historically. And, you know, yeah, is the gay rights movement over and in complete victory? No. But the reality is they know it. I mean, heck, it was even a year ago I had lunch with the president from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary right over in your part of town, and a couple of other people there. And they flat out admitted, like, yeah, we know we've lost. Like, all the indicators show the popular opinion has turned. It's over. It's just a matter of time now. It's like, well, and I asked him, like, well, if it's over, why are you wasting so much time and money continuing to try to strip people of their rights? Just why don't you put the money into poverty or education or something that could actually help the world? Oh, no, we can't give up that easily. And I think that's what a lot of this stuff is about still. It's just like, we can't give up. We got to keep trying to nail these people and make their lives difficult.
Well, then I'm glad that better sense has prevailed. At least Kansas was the big one, this week. That was kind of like the final. Woohoo! Okay. Let's put all these to rest. Now, they do keep popping up.
Yep.
They pop up here and there. I think Arizona has one right now, but it's like whack-a-mole. They pop up and hopefully I'd like to say the Constitution, but you know, it actually has been, because they're not going to stand up to judicial scrutiny. So we'll whack-a-mole them right back down again.
Yeah, I got an alert this morning, actually, from Americans United for Separation of Church and State about one of these that's popped up in Georgia. And I was looking through the actual law itself, and it's crazy. I mean, the law itself says, basically, you have the right to ignore every law as long as it's part of your sincerely held religious belief that ignoring it is okay. And this one, it wasn't just like LGBT specific. It was just kind of like broad base. And yeah, there was like a little exemption, like if the state can prove, and with the burden on the state, by the way, that this law, you know, that a certain law has to be followed because it's in the best interest of the state, then okay. But the burden is on the state. So like, I'm sure murder wouldn't get allowed, but you know, basically this would give people the right at the state level to violate any kind of law if there's a religious belief. So up to and including, it would seem, and I'm not a lawyer, but from my quick reading of it, it would seem like in the state, this law would allow someone to deny serving food to an atheist or a humanist if they wanted to. Now, of course, federal law would supersede that, and the Civil Rights Act of 64 would take precedent, but it's just kind of scary that they're passing laws that are directly contradictory to the Civil Rights Act. This is like,
it wasn't that long ago. You don't even have to look that far back in history. There's some kind of understanding that people don't want to look back 100 or 200 years, but for goodness sake, the civil rights movement was in the lifetimes of so many people that are alive right now. You know, my parents, good gracious, they lived through the 60s. They fought for this stuff, you know, and here they are. We're back at it again with these people, but we keep fighting and we keep winning. So that's good.
That is good. And momentum is on our side. And fortunately, the majority of the country is now on our side. So, you know, these people are, some people just can't give up their hate. And it's sad, but it's a good thing. At least these ones we've been winning so far, and we'll keep whack-a-moling. So,
yes, smacking them down. Well, what's up with you? What you've been working on this week? What you seen that's good?
Well, there is a big thing I'm working on, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet. I can't reveal that. Maybe next month's episode.
Oh, a teaser.
Yeah, a teaser.
You're not even going to tell me, are you? I can tell from your voice. I don't even get the inside track here, do
okay,
I?
Okay, I'll tell you just the topic. I've been putting a lot of effort into the OUT campaign of the Richard Dawkins Foundation, and we're going to be dramatically increasing it this year, amplifying it and expanding it. So I can't say anything else yet, but that's where a lot of my energy has been going lately.
Excellent. Well, you and I are out, I think.
I think I am.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Definitely out as a humanist at this point. Hard to jump back in that closet.
Yeah. Not that we were ever really in it.
No. So one big piece of news for AHA, and so that our listeners might be interested, because this affects this particular show, is that AHA has launched a new godless media outlet. I love the PR writing around that press release. I'm sure that got a lot more attention in the media because of it. But essentially, AHA has launched thehumanist.com, which is now live and offers daily original reporting, commentary on issues, articles from people like Greta Christina and Rob Boston, and all sorts of just cool information and news there, including under the multimedia section, the Humanist Hour. So that is our new home on the AHA's website. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool. So we can get all of our, I don't know, godless or God-free. I think that's probably a debate for those who are more versed in semantics than I am. But I'm also unicornless, and I am leprechaunless.
Exactly. So yeah, all sorts of old shows are on there, going back to Dar Williams, E.O. Wilson, Salman Rushdie. We have episodes with him on there. Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson. So yeah, go check it out. Check out some of the previous episodes and enjoy.
Some of those even predate you and I, huh? Can you imagine?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the page is up right now. And coincidentally, episode 59, introducing Todd Stiefel.
So very yes, nice. Here you are.
58 episodes before me. So I'm still like the new guy. I feel like the old guy sometimes here. Yeah. But yeah, gosh, we're up to episode 91 now. I guess this current one is episode 92. How about that?
Excellent. Oh, that's exciting. Well, Todd, I have one more piece of very good news that I would like to share this week. If anybody was following, right here in North Carolina, we had a young lady named Kaylee Wilson who tried to start, she and her brother Ben tried to start a secular student alliance in their high school, the Pisgah High School in Canton, North Carolina. And her brother Ben has left the school, but she continued the fight. And in spite of being told, in spite of there being, I believe it was at least 30 other clubs in the school, she was told repeatedly that there was no place for a secular student alliance, that it didn't really fit in there, and that there was nobody who would sponsor it. And she kept on, and with the help of the Freedom from Religion Foundation and the Secular Student Alliance and the ACLU of North Carolina, she prevailed. And probably with the amount of publicity that it got, it helped a little bit, but they now have a sponsor. Two teachers stepped up to offer, and then I guess one actually took the job, and they can have an SSA in Pisgah High School.
I think the good news on these kind of things, and for all the students out there listening, the law is on your side if you want to start a group. So my guess is the school kept saying no, and once the ACLU and FFRF sent their letter, the lawyers took a look at it and went, oh, yeah, we're going to lose really, really, really badly and owe lots of legal fees, and then we'll lose our jobs. So, yeah, if you're a student and you want to start a CFI on campus group or a secular student alliance group, you are totally allowed to. And if you can't find a faculty sponsor, that's tough luck for the school. They try to use that as an excuse, but they can't. They are required by law to assign you one, at least from my understanding of it. So, so you will win this fight. So if you want to fight your administration and win and get to gloat about it, that's always something fun you can do.
Indeed it is. And for her work, Kaylee, who has, it's been over a year now, I believe, that they've been fighting this, to recognize her, Camp Quest South Carolina has awarded her a campership, a full campership to Camp Quest South Carolina this year. That's nice. I'm sure that the first of many accolades coming her way.
Hooray for recognition and successful activism. Cheers to you, Kaylee.
Yep. No matter how old you are or how young you are, you can always stand up for what needs to happen in this world.
Speaking of students, SSA groups, and activism at that level, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about our guest this month, and somebody who does a lot of work with students, actually?
I would. We have, very happily, Dr. Anthony B. Pinn this month. Dr. Pinn is a professor of humanities and religious studies at Rice University, and I have seen several of his speeches talking to SSA and other folks. He's an amazing speaker. He is also the founder and executive director for the Center for Research and Collaborative Learning. And he'll speak to us today about those things, as well as being the director of research for the Institute for Humanist Studies, which is right near me in Washington, D.C.
Anthony Pinn, who we will call Tony, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a delight.
It's excellent to have you here. We actually have a lot to talk about. I was thinking we would just read the names of all of your books to our listeners, but then we'd only have like a minute to do the bio, because you've published about 100,000 books so far. I think your book from this week is, or 2 weeks ago, is your latest book. You're on pace for what, one a month, is it?
Not quite, but I appreciate that.
But you do have a brand new book, so I thought it would be cool to start out talking about that. So your newest book is Writing God's Obituary, How a Good Methodist Became a Better Atheist. Tell our listeners a little bit about it.
It's my intellectual autobiography, just some of the highlights. I started preaching when I was around the age of 12, long before I could vote. I was in the pulpit convincing people that they needed Jesus to avoid hellfire. And so I kind of move folks through that early phase and give them a sense of why that no longer worked for me. Lots of people assume, lots of theists assume that I left the church and became an atheist because I asked for something and didn't get it, right? That I prayed for something and God didn't grant it. It's really not that simple. It's more compelling than that. It's because it didn't work for other people. I'll give you one example. When I was a graduate student, I worked at a church in Roxbury in Boston, a rather economically challenged area. And across from the church was a park. And in this park, drug deals took place, prostitution took place, and my church had very little to say about those circumstances that was really substantive. We prayed about it, but we did nothing to help these young people. And these were young people at the church who had an easier time thinking about their deaths and their eulogies than thinking about a bright and productive future. And that troubled me. Here was a faith that had nothing useful to say to folks who were facing that kind of tragedy, that kind of despair. And I just had to let it go.
It's interesting that you said that you were preaching hellfire. I guess because I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire and there was actually a Methodist church there. And I don't know if it's just my experience, but I don't think of Methodists and hellfire together too often.
Oh, I was a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and there was something that was a bit evangelical about our approach, so hellfire was real for us. That produced the urgency, right? In the pulpit, you're facing all of these folks who are in jeopardy, that if they don't get themselves right, they will face eternal punishment, eternal damnation from a loving God. And so that was a big deal for us. It was not a matter of, I'm okay, you're okay.
So what is God's Obituary? How did that one start?
The title or the book?
The title.
I see my story kind of tied to the end of God's story. It's a kind of eulogy for God, but also a kind of celebration of new life for me and for those like me. I kind of think about this intellectual autobiography the way the great American thinker W.E.B. Du Bois thought about his autobiography. Right? I'm in no way in his class, but I think about this the same way, that for him, his personal story was an example of a larger story. And so I see my personal story, my movement from theism to atheism, as an example of a larger movement. There are lots of African Americans like me who've made this transition. And my story says something about their story. It says something about not only the loss of this idea of God, but the gaining of a greater sense of ourselves, a greater sense of our humanity and what we do in the world. My grandmother sent me off to college with these words. She said, "Move through the world knowing your footsteps matter." And from my perspective, this movement from theism to atheism made that real, that it gave me a way of recognizing my obligations and my responsibilities in the world, that there was nothing beyond human history pointing its finger at us and pulling the strings, but it was a matter of what we do to make a difference in the world. So what my grandmother said to me has a different weight, has a different importance now that I'm God free.
How much did theodicy lead you down that path?
Ah, theodicy, yes. Theodicy has always been a prime concern for me, the issue of what can you say about God in light of human suffering in the world, the moral evil issue. And as a theist, as a minister, I wrestled with this and argued that God is on the throne, all is well, that at the end of the day, God is going to make a difference. But this question kept pushing. It kept pushing. And with time, my response that God is making a difference just had no historical evidence. Right? But this was a fundamental question for me, not on the personal level again, but what's taking place with groups, right? What is happening with those who suffer most in the United States, and what does theism really offer them with respect to this issue of theodicy? And I reached the conclusion that it offered them very little, if anything.
I'm sorry, I got to take a quick aside, because you started that by saying God is on the throne, and I just got this image of a white bearded guy on the toilet. It's like, I don't think you meant that throne, though.
not that throne. Not that throne.
But, I mean, I agree with you. I think it was something I struggled with back in my religious days as well. It's just like, how do you... And I struggle with it now when I see some of these heartbreaking pictures. For example, these hurricane pictures that people whose homes were destroyed in the Philippines, where, you know, their houses are just complete, not just their houses, their whole villages are completely wiped out by what they believe to be God's wrath. And yet It makes their faith even stronger. And I think there was this one particular photo, I think it was like the AP photo of the year contest. And it's these people with behind them is just gone. There's nothing left. And they're carting out their most prized possessions and their religious relics.
Right.
And it's like, it boggles my mind. And so I'm curious as to your opinion. Why do those people become even more entrenched in their faith at these points, rather than taking on that theodicy question of, like, wait a minute, like I'm saving these relics from the God that just nuked my house?
Desperation and a deep fear of nihilism, right? From their perspective, if there is no God who provides an overarching meaning for the world, right, that makes sense out of the absurdity we encounter, then all is lost. For them, all is lost. So there's got to be something. There's got to be something. And faith becomes the Band-Aid, right? It becomes a way of acknowledging that this really doesn't make much sense to us. This tragedy doesn't make much sense to us, that there are issues of class and economics here that are in play, and it doesn't make sense to us, but there's God who has a different logic and will ultimately work this out. From their perspective, it seems to me that maintaining this faith provides a certain type of hope. It isn't grounded, but a certain type of hope over against nihilism. I prefer to move in a different direction. I think there's something wonderful in a phrase by the existentialist Albert Camus. We have to imagine Sisyphus happy. Right here you have this dude who's rolling this stone up the hill, knowing that it's going to come back down. He's just going to keep doing this, but there's something there. We have to imagine him happy. That is to say, rather than assuming that we have guaranteed outcomes, right, again, that this idea that God is on the throne and all is well, or in the language of Martin Luther King Jr., the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Rather than those ungrounded guarantees, we ought to be content with the idea of struggle. We try to make a difference in the world. We confront the absurdities of life and try to make a difference, recognizing that it may not work out for us, but it's what we can do.
I've watched several of your YouTube videos that are posted, and one of the things I found interesting, I grew up without religion at all. So the concept of, I think you called it redemptive suffering, has been fascinating to me. And you had quite a few things to say about that that I thought was interesting from, and now that I know that you were a Methodist and that was the only kind of church in my town, I'm even more interested.
It goes back to this issue of theodicy, and my argument has been, within the context of theisms, a dominant response has been this redemptive suffering argument. No cross, no crown is one way it gets phrased, that it's through this suffering that God brings about a major difference. And this can happen in several ways. For theists, this redemptive suffering argument can really kind of outline a sense of pedagogy, that we've done something wrong and God has to correct us so that we can be better people. It can be justified punishment. We've really screwed up and this is what we get for really screwing up. Or it can be a matter of thinking, well, this is a result of evil forces trying to keep me from getting my blessings, but I'm going to stay in line because this just demonstrates, this suffering I'm encountering demonstrates that I must be in line with God's will because evil forces are trying to distract me. And again, it seems to me this has been a dominant response, redemptive suffering. It's been a dominant response on the part of theists when they want to maintain a deep and abiding commitment to a sense of God, of a God who is loving, kind, just, and compassionate, but they're continuously encountering moral evil. Something has to give. And the way to hold together the major pieces of those two realities is to say, something wonderful can come out of this suffering.
So how do you combat that kind of mental shield? Because that's the way I kind of see things like that, is it's a way of shielding your mind from its own questions. How do you help people see that, and how do you combat it, if at all?
Well, I mean, there's a difficulty here in that theology is flexible, right? That you can make the Bible say whatever you want the Bible to say, and theology can be manipulated to provide whatever message you're interested in. It's particularly difficult for Christians because the major highlight of their story involves redemptive suffering. Jesus the Christ coming and sacrificing self for the greater good, right? And Christians are supposed to be Christ-like. So the idea that suffering is redemptive is unavoidable in that context. It seems to me one thing to do is to work to humanize Jesus and to kind of think about this differently. So there are theologians, for example, who argue that, well, there's a different way to think about this Christ event, a different way to think about the cross, that we might want to understand this as a huge indicator that people can screw up a good thing. Here you have this guy who's providing pretty interesting moral lessons, and what do? We knock him off, right? So from their perspective, the lesson in the passion of Christ is not a positive lesson, nothing we need to imitate, but it's a matter of humility, recognizing that we have to be careful because we can screw good stuff up. It seems to me that's a move in the right direction for folks who are going to maintain their theism. Understand the Christ event as a negative lesson, not a positive lesson. Nothing we need to imitate, but something we need to avoid.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, your areas of expertise and study have revolved around African-American religion and African-American humanism. Do you see kind of any distinct differences in this redemptive suffering theology between African-American religion versus European-American religion?
Well, it seems to me there is a major difference, and this major difference is context, in that African-American religion pulls from a history of enslavement and dehumanization that takes place in a particular way. And so it seems to me, within the context of African-American communities and African-American humanism or African-American theism, it kind of draws from this experience that is rather unique, this experience of slavery and continued dehumanization based upon a particular understanding of race. And I think the issue for people of European descent is a bit different. That while there might be difficulties encountered by people of European descent, by and large, this difficulty has never involved a full-on questioning of their humanity.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Something else that is one of your major kind of areas of interest is theological issues involving the body. Can you tell me more
Yes.
about that?
My thing is, in the study of religion, and the study of religion and the practice of religion, the body has been missing for the most part. That it's been a matter of ideas without any real attention to our embodied bodies, this thing that is born, lives, and dies. Within the context of religious communities, I see this being the case to the extent that religious communities have done such a horrible job in terms of issues of sexuality. Right, they've done a horrible job with respect to how one goes about informing young people on sex and sexuality. And so when I was growing up in the church, it was not uncommon for us to be told. And then as a minister, this was my first response as well. It wasn't uncommon for young people to be told, look, do whatever you want to do sexually, knowing that Jesus is in the room.
Oh.
Now, what kind of response is this?
That's Ew. Creepy.
You know, what kind of response is this? But we did such a poor job of dealing with issues of sexuality. So it's still uncommon in Christian circles to have healthy and productive conversations concerning masturbation, for example. Even images of Jesus, for the most part, don't represent him as having a penis. Right? So it becomes extremely difficult then for Christians to have a conversation concerning what Jesus may have done with this penis, who may have been pleasured by this penis, or who may have pleasured him based upon this penis, right? This is not a part of, it's not a part of their iconography, it's not a part of the conversation. And my thing is this, if the study of religion is going to have any substance, going to have any meaning, it's got to take seriously the fact that we move through this world as embodied beings. And that this embodied being and how it occupies time and space is the starting point and the end point for all religious and non-religious conversation.
It's the alpha and omega, if you will.
There you go.
I do find that whole concept fascinating and disturbing, the whole idea of, like, Jesus is watching you in the bedroom. Is that referred to as the voyeur Jesus theology?
It should have been. You know, when I was growing up, we just thought, oh, this is a clever response. Right? This will keep those sexual urges in check. No one wants to be in this room with Jesus wagging his finger at them.
Or anything else.
There you go.
If Jesus can watch, so can you.
But just a, you know, just an example of how our churches misrepresent issues and don't deal adequately with basic human urges and needs.
Yeah, there's too many blanks to fill in. It's almost a childlike, you know, kids, if they're going to go figure it out on their own if you don't give them something to work with. And without a good, solid life experience worth of data, then you're not going to figure things out right. Or if you do, it's probably going to be by chance.
Yeah. And to the extent that religious communities see themselves as helping people move through the world in ways that are productive, how do you not address these sorts of basic issues?
One of the things that you do is the director of research for the Institute for Humanist Studies. Do you find that your thoughts on that are actually 180 degrees, excuse me, your work that you do, it is at 180 degrees from what you learned as Jesus as a threesome?
Oh, yeah. I mean, worlds apart. But deeply consistent with what I do as a scholar of religion and humanism, right? That my thing is this. I study religion not because I have any personal allegiance to theistic faith claims, but simply because religion has been an extremely powerful cultural development. It has shaped how people understand themselves, how they understand the world, now how they understand their interactions with the world. And we ought to know something about this. I also believe that humanism functions in a very similar way. It provides a life orientation. It helps us make meaning. Now, it can do this without the overarching idea of a God, but it's a way of making life meaningful. And the Institute for Humanist Studies provides a way of wrestling with this. What is the nature and meaning of humanism? How does it impact folks on the individual level, and how does it impact us on the level of communities? What are ways in which humanism might inform our political lives, our economic lives, our cultural and social lives? It's a way of kind of unpacking this alternate life orientation. And so I see commonalities there. Helps me bring dimensions of who I am together.
In one of the interviews that I listened to with you, I wish I could give the person credit because I don't remember which one it was, but you actually referred to, I believe, as humanism as religion.
I think it can function that way. My argument has never been that humanism or atheism have to be understood as religion. But here's the key. That the statement, when I've argued that humanism functions as a religion, what's important there is how I'm defining religion. That I don't understand religion as being tied to institutions, doctrines, and creeds, but I simply understand religion as a quest for complex subjectivity. That is to say, I understand religion as the human effort confined to human history, the human effort to understand who, what, when, where, and why we are. And so from my perspective, to the extent humanism and atheism help us to understand and wrestle with who, what, when, where, and why we are, one could understand them as being religious orientations. But again, it's premised upon a particular definition of religion.
I'm a little confused by this concept of quest for complex subjectivity. So you said that's the who, what, when, where, and why we are. So help me understand that more.
By complex subjectivity, I mean it's our effort to come up with a robust, deep, and complex sense of who we are as individuals and individuals within the context of community. And by that, I mean it's our effort to come up with rich and complex responses to the who are we, what are we, why are we, and where are we questions, the fundamental questions of life.
Ah, so like including like how we fit into the universe and what our role is. And
yes, yes. All of those fundamental questions. For me, the suggestion that humanism and atheism might qualify as religious orientations was an effort to get us to think more fully and in robust and creative ways about the nature and meaning of humanism and atheism. What are they outside of ways to critique, ways to think about separation of church and state, for example, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to live humanism and atheism? It was my way of getting us to think about those sorts of questions, those dimensions of humanism and atheism.
As research director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, what is your day-to-day role with that, and what is IHS doing right now?
As director of research for the Institute for Humanist Studies, my primary obligations are, one, to develop and manage our annual symposium. We bring really interesting thinkers to the Rice campus to wrestle with a particular issue. One year we wrestled with theism's impact on public policy. Another year we wrestled with the fundamental question, what is humanism and why does humanism matter? Those papers given during the symposium we publish in book form, and that's my second responsibility. I developed and I manage our book series. It's with Palgrave Macmillan, Academic Division of St. Martin's Press, and we are interested in publishing books that, again, explore various dimensions of humanism, what it is and how it functions in the world. Some of those books come out of our symposium, but we also invite proposals from folks not affiliated with the Institute. I'm also consulting editor for Essays in the Philosophy of Humanism. And in that role, my responsibility is to help think through themes for the various issues, to help secure submissions for the journal, to help publicize the journal, just to kind of manage its intellectual profile. So those are the basic responsibilities for me.
Do you sleep at night, or do you just work all the time?
No, I sleep. I just try to be very careful in terms of scheduling. So I developed as an undergraduate a real comfort with and a deep like for multitasking. So I'm typically working on 3, 4, 5 things simultaneously, right? Because one project, one bit of work will feed another. I also have some really excellent help, and so that's been vital. I've got a good group of graduate students who help me with a lot of this work. Mrs. Meyer Rain, who is the assistant director for the center I run at Rice, also helps me with some of this work. So I've got a really good team here, and this team keeps me going.
I love that you work with the young people, with the students, and I hate that I'm not considered one of them anymore. I hate that I have to use the word young people.
You're a student of life, Kim.
I am.
And that still counts.
Thank you so much. You guys make me feel better.
Do you get a discount at the movie theater for that?
Yeah. I think I'm closer to the one on the other edge of the spectrum at this point. But one of the interviews that I watched was a speech that you had done for the SSA actually several years ago, but it was very interesting to me because what you talked about was bringing African Americans into your group and the ways to go about doing that. I actually learned a lot from that. I was wondering if you could give us a few words on that, since we are in the month of February, which is not only Black History Month, but also the month of the Day of Solidarity for Black Nonbelievers.
It seems to me that there are several things, because I get this question all the time, how do we diversify? How do we get more African Americans involved? And it seems to me it requires at least three things. One, it requires a real interest in diversifying. And that real interest means not only bringing people in so that you have different shades of the same, but recognizing that in bringing folks in, you are altering what this group thinks, what this group does, the kind of projects and concerns that are in the forefront, that bringing folks in fundamentally changes everything. And people have to be comfortable with that. Secondly, it seems to me that we have to use the same kind of inquisitiveness that we have with everything else. We have to apply that to our interactions with African Americans, for example, so that it's insufficient, inadequate to simply say, I don't know very much about that community. Learn something. Know something about the people you're interested in interacting with. Right? Know something about them. There are lots of books, lots of articles, lots of YouTube videos. There are lots of ways to learn something about this community you're interested in. Third, approach them based upon the issues that matter to them and recognize this will take time. Right? Kind of approach this based upon the issues that matter to them and recognize that this sort of relationship, this sort of collaboration will take time.
So, Tony, what do you think of the Day of Solidarity for Black Nonbelievers? Is that a good step for local groups to start becoming more diverse if they are not already?
I think it's fantastic. I think that's a way of celebrating diversity, but I don't know that it's a way of producing diversity. I think actually producing diversity will be a bit more difficult to achieve. Yeah, you know, and one of my suggestions has always been this. We may not be interested in church memberships, but there may be something to learn from them. That one of the things we might want to do if we're interested in diversifying is study some of these organizations that seem to be doing it fairly well. We don't have to take their theology, right? We don't have to buy their doctrine, but there's something about their organization, there's something about their outreach and their inreach that it's productive, and we might want to learn something from them. But in terms of the celebration, it's wonderful, but creating greater diversity will require more work. And I think one of the things that's necessary is this, that we've got to give, in this case, African Americans, a different experience. That for those, for African Americans like me who've left the church, simply bashing religion doesn't get us any further. We left the church. We understand. Right, but the question for us becomes, what kind of alternate community is being made available? And what kind of needs will this community address? Bashing religion in and of itself is insufficient. We've got to give folks alternate ways of moving through the world. We've got to give them alternate communities that celebrate and enhance their sense of humanism or atheism. And I think this is often where we've fallen short. We're pretty good when it comes to issues of economics and politics, but not as good when it comes to issues of community, how one celebrates and arranges life, how one, and here's the bad word, ritualizes life. It seems to me that's the kind of stuff we need to give greater attention to if we're actually interested in diversifying.
Does your research give you any indication as to whether that needs to start in the minority communities? Does it have to start with Black folks, or is there a way for non-Black folks to start or to continue, I guess, some of that work?
Well, I think there's enough work to go around. I think African American organizations can do some of this, but the larger movement, it seems to me, needs to rethink how it approaches issues of diversity. So, for example, one way to do this within the larger movement is to make certain that African Americans, for example, aren't simply invited to annual meetings to talk about race, right? But kind of recognize that we have a range of interests and capacities. And rather than having us come and talk about race, ask PZ to talk about race, right? Ask some of these other folks to talk about race, because to the extent we don't do that, to the extent we have racial minorities talking about diversity and race, it comes across as special pleading. It's only of concern to those people. But we make it an issue for the larger movement and the largest group within this movement. We make it a more expansive issue if we push beyond the usual suspects speaking about these issues.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. So we don't have a ton of time left in this interview, but I definitely wanted to hit on something that you seem to have a bit of a passion about, and I believe it even wrote an entire book about, which is this intersection between humanism and music.
Yes, particularly hip hop.
Yeah, so I mean, so two things I don't usually think of together in my associative memory patterns here is humanism and hip hop. There are certainly certain individuals, like Graydon Square and Bobby Brinkman and others who I think of in that line, but kind of in the popular, selling substantial amounts on iTunes or getting airplay, I don't think of those two concepts together very much, but do you see a lot of humanism in kind of more mainstream, popular hip-hop?
I see within popular, platinum-level hip-hop particular humanist principles. So, for example, take Kanye West and Jay-Z's No Church in the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that starts out with the refrain, right, what is God to a non-believer who doesn't believe in anything, right? It raises questions concerning the underpinning of authority in the Western world, right? It raises a profound critique concerning these underpinnings, whether it be the church, God, political authority, raises questions concerning those in profound ways. Or Kanye West, I Am a God, raises really interesting questions for us. Or even Jesus Walks, right? Christians love this, but there are ways in which that song raises questions concerning some of the moral and ethical assumptions Christians make. All of this, I think, is really important stuff for us to investigate. But when I first mentioned hip-hop culture and humanism, my thinking was this. We're constantly talking about being marginalized in the larger U.S. society, and this is true. And we've talked about wanting to grow and expand and get the word out concerning what we offer. My thinking was this. Here you have with hip-hop culture the creativity of a rather despised population, brown and black kids, in economically challenged sections of Los Angeles, New York, Philadelphia, etc. A rather marginal community that has taken their creativity and made it global. For me, there may be lessons embedded in how hip-hop culture has developed and grown, there may be lessons embedded in that that could be of use to humanists as we try to expand and grow. So, I wasn't telling folks they needed to let the pants sag or wear their baseball caps backwards. I was simply saying that there are some structural insights, some branding insights that hip-hop offers us, and we ought to take them seriously.
What are some of those insights you think we might be able to leverage ourselves?
One, that our language, our vocabulary and grammar, how we talk about humanism, needs to be organic. That is to say, it needs to draw from the insights, the vocabulary, the signs, the symbols of a given community. Right? So it's got to be flexible enough to be able to speak to different segments of the population. Whereas we tend to operate based upon a one-size-fits-all model. But it's got to be organic. It's got to grow out of the sensibilities, and it's got to grow out of the language of given communities. It seems to me if we start with that, we might gain some ground.
And I was thinking you have a great opportunity to inspire the students that you work with to use their own communities as students and then go back to wherever they are or go forward to wherever they're going to and bring that message in words that perhaps someone my age wouldn't be able as flexible enough to do.
Right, that we've got to speak in a way that is sensitive to the audience. And I think that's an important lesson we can learn from hip-hop. Speak in a way that makes sense to the audience.
I think that makes a ton of sense. Now, did you see similar things when you've looked at the blues and humanism?
One of the things that I think humanists ought to take away from the blues is the earthiness, mm-hmm. right? That's extremely important, the kind of earthiness, a recognition that we are embodied bodies moving through the world. I think that's extremely important. But even more important than that, it seems to me one of the things we ought to take away from the blues is a kind of measured realism, that humanists have drawn from the Enlightenment a kind of hyper-optimism with respect to human capacity and capability. And the blues helps us to get some perspective on this. And that perspective involves the recognition that we often screw stuff up, that our progress is not inevitable, that we have the capacity to really screw things up in profound ways, and we've got to be sensitive to that. That it seems to me that we often, as humanists, share a kind of hyper-optimism with theists. Now, theirs is grounded in God. Ours is often grounded in science, a kind of truncated sense of science. The blues teaches us that, to the extent there are people involved, we may get it wrong. But we ought to struggle, we ought to work to make a difference, not because we have guaranteed outcomes, but rather because it's what we can do.
We got to pay our dues.
Yeah.
And Tony, one of the things that Todd and I like to do is we usually find a good quote to end our segments with. And the one that I found that's been sticking with me since I started finding out who you were and finding out more about you was actually my humanism quote comes from you this week. And that is that the human is the measure of all things. And I think that speaks very well to everything that you were just talking about. So I'm taking that with me this week and offering it to everyone else. Because
and I actually borrowed that.
You did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Nice. And who would that be?
Well, with this, Corliss Lamont.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Corliss Lamont.
Tony.
Via Tony.
Tony, is there anything else you want to talk about before we go?
No. I mean, I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you both. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been a fun conversation.
Too. Yep. I can't wait to get into your books.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
Well, next time we bump into each other at a conference or something, we'll have to get a drink and listen to some music together.
Oh, that sounds great. We'll have
I
to
love
do
the
that.
Blues. Me too. Can I come?
Of course.
Absolutely.
And
of Jesus course. Will be watching. Awesome. Thanks so much for being on the show, Tony.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you to Tony Pinn for being on the show this month. I thought that was a interesting interview. As a matter of fact, I had like 10 or 12 more questions written down that I didn't get to, but I kind of suspected that once I started doing my research. And,
yes.
And my question list got massive because he's a busy man.
He really is. If you go to Amazon.com and look at his list of books, or also on his website, which is I forgot to write it down.
His website is anthonypinn.com, which actually is a great and very thorough website. If you click on publications and books, it goes for a long way. The man is a prolific writer.
He's a prolific writer, and his titles are very enticing. Yeah, I'm ready to read. I'm actually flying out to LA. I've got a couple of hours, so I'm grabbing a couple of those before I go.
Fantastic. Yeah, and you know what? He's just a great guy, too. I've gotten the opportunity to spend a little time with him at different events, and he's just a really nice, down-to-earth man. I dig him. So, awesome. Listeners, also, please be sure, if you are on Facebook, to like us there. It's the Humanist Hour. And also, if you have any comments or questions or just want to speak randomly into Google, which will botch it and send us that, feel free to call us at our listener comment line, 202-618-1371. And, of course, you can check us out at thehumanisthour.org as part of the humanist.com new website for those previous episodes, show notes, links to people we've talked about and talked to on the show, all sorts of great, interesting things you can find there.
Excellent. I think that wraps it up. That was great. I loved meeting him today. And as always, Todd, I love talking with you. And
indeed, I'm sure I will be seeing you soon. So thanks a lot, listeners. It's been a great month, and we look forward to talking to you next month.
Thanks, y'all.
Nobody without telling me. Sunglasses and Advil. Last night was mad real. Sun coming up 5 a.m. I wonder if they got calves still. Think about the girl in all leopard who was rubbing the wood like Kiki Shepherd. Two tattoos, one red, no apologies. The other said love is cursed by monogamy. That's something that the pastor don't preach. That's something that a teacher can't teach. When we die, the money we can't keep. Probably spend it all cause the pain ain't cheap. Preach.
Human beings in a mob. What's a mob to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer?